Welcome to the session. My name is Christopher Hudson. I teach at ACU. And I'm here to talk about uppity women in the New Testament. I'm interested in the question that we've all been interested in for a good generation now, about women's roles in the church, women in ministry, and those sorts of things. But I'd like to expand on a part of the argument that I think needs a little rounded out. And that is, what do we mean when we talk about one of these passages being cultural? I get so much pushback on that. On what basis can you say that this or that verse is culturally relevant to the first century, but not culturally relevant to the 21st century? Because most honest, God-fearing people who just want to read the Bible and do what it says, they're hesitant, I guess, about making that distinction. It feels like I'm selling out if I say, well, that doesn't apply to me. So how do we think about this? So I would like to think a little bit about especially 1 Timothy 2 today, but I think you'll see the remarks have some bearing also on 1 Corinthians 11. The issue of how women dress, proper attire for women. A woman of decorum in the first century. What did that mean? Because I think it's pretty important to the author of 1 Timothy. No, I lost my Bible. Where did I put my Bible down? I know I came in here with one. It's around here somewhere. Fortunately, I have a backup on my phone. The author of 1 Timothy, now, I don't know how invested you are in the authorship question of the letters to Timothy and Titus. Is that an important or problematic question for you? Are you aware that, I think you're probably aware, that the question is at least debated in academic circles? Did the same author who wrote Romans and Galatians also write 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus? There are reasons to at least make you ask questions about that. If you're committed to Pauline authorship, I want to make space for you on that, but I should just warn you that I'm not sure I can fit all the Paul pieces into that puzzle. And I'm comfortable with the idea that these letters were written in a post-Pauline generation. And I think you'll see maybe one reason why today, but that's not really the main point of my argument. The main point is to understand why it's important for, let's call him Pastoral Paul. And if Pastoral Paul means the same thing as Paul, that's great. And if Pastoral Paul means the guy who wrote these letters who goes by the pseudonym Paul, then so you can take that either way you want to take it. Why was it so important for Pastoral Paul to comment on clothing and attire of women? Women who profess piety toward God. How should they dress? How should they comport themselves? One thing I'd like to notice, and this is really important, because so many discussions of this passage begin in verse 9, or, if we're lucky, verse 8. And we read the second half of the chapter, verses 8 through 15, because that's the section on women. Well, verse 8 is about men, but we recognize that verse 8 is the same sentence as verse 9, so we take that too. But we tend to read that paragraph divorced from its context, and I think it might be important for us to begin in verse 1 of chapter 2. And so if you have a Bible open in front of you, what is the issue in the first 7 verses of 1 Timothy chapter 2?
That they're peaceful and quiet.
Okay, there's something about being peaceful and quiet. Now, how do we get to the issue of being peaceful and quiet?
Prayer.
Yeah, I exhort you first of all that, and I've got a whole bunch of synonyms for different kinds of prayers. So any kind of prayers, thanksgivings, petitions, whatever you want to call these things, all your different ways and types of praying, you give all of these prayers on behalf of all people. There is a strong assumption here that whatever the gospel means, it has a universal implication. Prayers on behalf of all people, but specifically on behalf of kings and all those who are in authority, so that we may live peaceable and quiet lives in all piety and solemnity. So there's that issue of peaceableness and quietness. How do we connect these things? What's at stake when we pray for rulers? If we want to say this is culturally determined, we say here's a prayer for kings, and you want to say here's a case where we say, well, in our culture, we don't have a king. There are some kings in the world today, but we don't have a king that we pray for. We pray for a president, and so we say there's a cultural adaptation we'll make, and we can easily make that adaptation. We say we're not losing anything. We're being faithful to the text, right? But do we have a sense that our prayer for our leaders, our political leaders, that what is at stake for us is that we might be allowed to live a peaceable and quiet life? Is that at stake for us? What's at stake for Christians living in the first century under the Roman Empire? We're praying for rulers, for kings and all those in authority of all different levels. This is good and acceptable before God, our Savior, who wants all people to be saved. Now, there's that universal implication of the gospel again. Wants all people to be saved and come to a knowledge of truth. And why do we have this assumption that God wants all people to be saved? Because now we have a theological affirmation. Sorry. Didn't mean to close the door in your face. Sorry, the bridegroom has come. You're welcome to join us over here. Put yourself in first century shoes and imagine what it means to affirm the theological proposition, God is one. Do you see the theological proposition that's laid out for us here in verse 5? God is one. Now, you have no hesitation about affirming God is one, do you? Because you're good Jewish people. Or at least you've been informed by a Jewish mindset. You're familiar with the scriptures of Israel. You think the affirmation that God is one is pretty fundamental to faith, right? There is one God. But if you read the scriptures of Israel, you know that the proposition, God is one, the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, Deuteronomy 6:4, this affirmation that is recited in every synagogue service, this affirmation that is fundamental to the identity of the Jewish people necessarily implies a claim that, and there are no other gods. Well, if you live in the Roman Empire in the first century, when you affirm God is one, you're calling into question the gods that are understood to be the foundation of the Roman Empire. Roman sense of self-identity is that we are descended from the god Venus, the goddess of love. We are descended from the god Mars, the god of war. We have a divine right to rule the world. The gods are on our side. Not only that, in the first century, the religious development in the Roman Empire is to claim that the Caesar himself is divine. And so there are temples to Caesar springing up all over the eastern part of the empire, starting in the province of Asia, to which this letter is addressed, in the city of Ephesus. When we say Asia, we mean the province at the western end of what we call Turkey today, a Roman province called Asia. So Ephesus was the chief center, chief city of that province. All right, now, when you affirm God is one, you are implicitly denying the existence of all other gods, including Caesar. Are you committing treason? Are you out on a limb? Are you on thin ice? What if you represent a religion that is A, foreign? Romans were always very suspicious of foreign religions. And B, a new religion. They're suspicious of new religions. So Judaism kind of gets a pass because it's recognized as a very ancient religion, and specific laws and decrees have been passed by the Romans for generations, certifying Judaism and the rights of the Jewish people to practice their quirky religion that's out of sync with everybody else's religion. But what about Christianity? There are Christians who claim that they're a version of Judaism. We're the true blue Jews, right? But there are other Jews who say, no, they're not. You're not Jews. So within the Jewish community, there are Pharisee Jews and there are Christian Jesus follower Jews, and they disagree with each other. To the extent that the Jesus following Jews are pushed out of the synagogue as we go later into the first century, they're kind of out there by themselves. They begin to be distinguished from the synagogue as a different religious group. But they're not on the approved list. You remember when the Iron Curtain fell in Eastern Europe 20 years ago? There's a rush for churches to say, we've got to send missionaries into Eastern Europe. Missionaries. But how do you get into Russia to start setting up a mission? Are you a recognized church? Are you on the approved list? Are you Russian Orthodox? Are you some other flavor of Orthodox? No? Well, then who are you? And they keep a pretty close list. Are you an approved group or not? If you're not one of the groups on our list, then it's very difficult to operate. Think of Rome kind of like that. Christianity was a new foreign religion. It had not been given any legal status. It had been recognized on the approved list. And they went around affirming God is one, which is the basic affirmation here in 1 Timothy 2:5. God is one. There's one God. There's one mediator between God and humans, the human Jesus Christ, who gave himself a ransom for all. I want you to pray for kings. If you are a loyal subject to the Roman Empire, you are expected to pray to Caesar. Can you as a Christian pray to Caesar? No. Christians don't pray to Caesar. But Christians adopt the long-standing Jewish tradition. Philo reports this. Josephus reports this. This is a long-standing Jewish tradition. In fact, it goes back to Jeremiah. Pray for the peace of the city in which you've been taken captive, in which you live, this foreign city. That we do not pray to the emperor, because the emperor is not God. We do not pray to the emperor, but we go out of our way to pray for the emperor twice a day. We have official sacrifices in our temple in Jerusalem for the emperor. That was the Jewish custom. So they would say, we are not treasonous. We're not about an insurrection here. Well, of course, there was a Jewish revolt in AD 64, but yeah. But before that, we're not trying to be treasonous. We're not trying to start an insurrection. We're trying to be loyal subjects, but also loyal to our God. And Christians adopted that strategy. We affirm God is one, and we pray for kings, which is exactly the exhortation here. I want, first of all, for you to pray for kings and rulers. Now, secondly, I want the men in every place to pray lifting holy hands. All right, men. You see the posture? Some ancient church fathers say the posture of prayer kind of resembles the posture of the cross. Kind of does, doesn't it? What's happening? I'm holding up my hands to receive from God. I'm petitioning God. So, I don't know what this is. I don't know. Somebody made this up. I don't know. But this is the traditional ancient posture for prayer. And here it is on a catacomb fresco from the 3rd century. And there are many depictions of this in sculpture and in paintings from antiquity, both Jewish and Christian art, representing people at prayer in this position. I want men in every place to lift holy hands without anger or quarreling. And likewise, the women, to do what? Here's why I say we're continuing the same sentence. You really can't start at verse 9, because no matter how it's punctuated in your English translation, trust me, there's one sentence that's all in verses 8 and 9. So the verb is, I want, in verse 8, I want the men in every place to pray, lifting holy hands, and likewise the women to do what? To dress modestly, to adorn themselves in clothing of decorum. How about if we say to decorate themselves with clothing of decorum, with modesty and temperance. Now, here's what you need to get is a Greek word. There is a verb, kosmeo, which means to adorn or decorate. There is the noun, kosmos, which is our word, kosmos. We spell it with the C, coming from Latin. We kosmos, C, the universe, kosmos. We have an adjective, kosmios. Let's start with kosmos, the noun. The noun kosmos, the opposite of kosmos is chaos, chaos. If you want to talk about the creation of the world, you talk about how the primordial soup was chaos. But, depending on what religion you're in, some god or team of gods brought order out of the chaos and created the world. If you're reading Genesis, it's Yahweh who brings order out of chaos and creates the world, and pushes back the water, and creates dry land. But in Greek and Roman creation myths, the thing that's called order, the kosmo, this is order. It's the opposite of chaos. So there's a whole conception that the world as created by God is created orderly. There's a place for everything, and everything in its place. People or things that are out of order cause chaos. You see? So there is an order for society. And we project onto our social conventions that God or the gods created the world this way and meant for the things to be arranged this way in this order. Certain people are ordained by the gods to rule, and certain people are ordained by the gods to be slaves. And so on. It's an orderly world. Now, the verb, kosmeo, means to order, to put in order. Kosmios is an adjective, orderly. But these verbs, nouns, adjectives, also have the connotation of decoration. So I can talk about something being decorous. I can talk about decoration. I can talk about decorating something. And this is the group of words that we're dealing with when we're talking about clothing and attire for women. I want men in every place to pray lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. That's part of our Christian witness to the whole world. We have to model what we're about. And we're not about anger and quarreling. We're about a peaceable and quiet lifestyle. We need to model that in our prayer and our communal life with each other. So we pray this way. And further, I want women to decorate themselves. How? How do women decorate themselves? I want women to decorate themselves with clothing, let's see, I lost my verse. I can scroll back down. There it is. With decorous clothing, with modesty, and with temperance. So what is decorous clothing? let's say clothing of decorum. Clothing of decorum, mm-hmm. modesty, and temperance. These are the three synonyms. This is how I want women to decorate themselves, with clothing of decorum and modesty and temperance. Not with braided hair. Let's see. We have a violator. Okay. Not with gold. I think we probably have a room full of violators. At least all the married people in the room probably have at least a little gold on them. Got mine right here, but I'm a man and it doesn't say men can't. Not with braids, not with gold, not with pearls. Anybody want to confess that you have some back at the house? But you're going to donate them to Agape when you get home, right? Okay. Not with expensive clothing. I had a woman raise her hand one time in a Sunday school class. She said, what if I have an expensive dress, but I got it on sale for cheap? Well, let's think about that. What's the point of the instruction? You don't adorn yourselves or you don't decorate yourselves with braids, with gold, with pearls, with expensive clothes, but with what is appropriate for women who profess piety toward God with good works. Now, I've set around a handout in which I've shown you a text. We'll talk about women who profess piety toward God. And the first text on your handout, I'll also put on the screen here, is from Plutarch, who lives at the end of the first century, beginning of the second century. Plutarch is a Platonist philosopher. Do we have any extra copies? Were there any more copies? Okay, it's coming over. Thank you. You can also email me for a copy if you need one. Plutarch, who lives at the end of the first, beginning of the second century, so depending on when you date 1 Timothy, maybe around the time when 1 Timothy was written, maybe a little after. The Sicilian despot Dionysius sent clothing and jewelry of the costly kind to the daughters of Lysander. Lysander was the king of Sparta. But Lysander would not accept them, saying, quote, these adornments will disgrace my daughters far more than they will adorn them. It's not gold or precious stones or scarlet that makes her such, but whatever invests her with something which betokens dignity. That's one of the words in our text, dignity. Good behavior and modesty. That's one of the things that Pastoral Paul says, I want women to adorn themselves with modesty. Here's our word. The jewelry, the fancy clothes, this is not what I want my daughters to look like, even though they're daughters of a king. The second text I don't have on the screen, but I'll read it to you because it's so interesting as a parallel for our passage. It's from certainly later than our period. It's a Pythagorean letter, which is to say from the Pythagorean school of philosophy, which was one of the ancient schools of philosophy, even older than Socrates. But from the 3rd century of the Christian era, a letter written by Melissa. So this is interesting, a philosophical text written by a woman to a woman. A philosophical woman advising a woman on how to behave. Melissa to Clarita, greetings. It appears to me that on your own accord you have most good attributes. For your earnest wish to hear about a wife's decorum, and here's our word, ευκοσμία, the cosmos, κοσμία. A wife's decorum offers good hope that you are going to grow old in accordance with virtue. So then, the temperate, and sophron is the word, sophrosyne is the word that comes up in verse 15 in our passage, and also in verse 9 or 10. She should be temperate. The married woman must belong to her lawful husband, adorned with quietness. The word is hesychia, the same word that comes up, we should live a peaceable and quiet life in our prayer. Also that we want women to adorn themselves with quietness. Hesychia. She should be dressed in clothing that is white, clean, and simple. In other words, you know, white is the natural color of wool. We're not wasting money on dyes and decorations. Not very expensive, politeli, exactly the same word that Pastoral Paul uses, not expensive clothing. Not excessive. And it doesn't matter if it's a gift in this case. It doesn't matter if you got it cheap on sale. The whole point is the image that you're projecting, not expensive clothing. She ought to avoid garments of purple cloth. Purple is exceedingly expensive. So you think of Lydia in the book of Acts. She is a high-end retailer. Those who are shot through with purple and gold, imagine a garment woven with gold thread. I mean, we're talking expensive clothing here. That's the sort that's useful for courtesans. So there's a sexual suggestion here. It's not just women of power and wealth who wear this kind of clothes, but also women who are trying to attract the eye of men for other reasons than to demonstrate their power and their wealth. So courtesans in their hunting of men. But the decor, the cosmos, the decor proper to women who is well-pleasing to only one man, her own man, is her character and not her clothing. So in paragraph 2, you should have a blush as a sign of modesty on your face instead of rouge. Goodness and the height of decorum, and here's our word again, temperance, sophrosyne, the same word that comes up in our passage, instead of gold and emeralds, because the temperate woman should be enthusiastic for expensive, should be enthusiastic for the expense of clothing and of the body, but for the management and the preservation of her household. I think there's a missing not in there. She should be not for the expensive clothing. She should please her own husband by completing his desires, since the wishes of her husband ought to be an unwritten law to the woman of decorum. So she should adorn herself with orderly behavior. Does this get the wheels turning in your mind? Now, we're living in a cultural context in which there's a highly structured society and a strong sense on religious grounds that everything should be very orderly. People have a place and a role in life. And clothing reflects that. I'd like to talk a little bit about how clothing reflects that. The value that the Romans called pudicitia is what the Greeks called modesty or temperance. This is how they reflect that. Here's a funerary monument from the late Republican period, let's say the end of the first century BCE. Husband and wife represent themselves as good, upstanding, decent Roman people. All right, how do they portray themselves as good, upstanding, decent Roman people? Well, he wears a toga, so he's a good, upstanding, decent Roman citizen man. She has the hem of her garment. Can you tell that her garment is pulled up on the back of her head? So can you see? That's not her hair dangling down. That's the hem of her toga pulled up so that it's hanging down from the back of her head. What this says is, I am a married woman. This is the origin of the custom of the bridal veil. It's the thing that covers the head and hangs out the back. It doesn't cover the face. But it says, I'm a married woman to a man. I am a woman of modesty and temperance. If you want a close-up picture of that, here's a picture of Livia, who was the wife of Augustus. There are statues of Livia all over the Roman Empire because Augustus went around the empire on these photo ops with his wife. He took his wife with him and made a point of being seen with her in public in this attire. She wore the veil over her head to show that she's a good, modest, decent woman. She's a model for women throughout the empire. As a side note, if you're going to overthrow hundreds of years of democratic government and replace it with a military dictatorship, then a good way to divert people's attention from that is to start a campaign for family values. This is Augustus's propaganda. So he made sure that there were images of his wife all over the empire saying, we represent traditional religion, law and order, family values. Oh, and by the way, never mind the military dictatorship. That's how you get peace and security. Just say it. Here's another woman from the first century. Now, would you say she's a decent, upstanding, fine woman of modesty and decorum? In this case, however, she happens to have another role, but we'll get to that. This woman is very famous. She lived in Pompeii about the time of Paul. And here's an overview of the city of Pompeii. This is the Forum in downtown Pompeii. So this is open space. The Capitolium is the temple of Roma in the middle of the Forum. These are city government buildings at this end. And this is the largest building in town. This building was built by Almachia. This Roman woman, whose statue we just saw, there's a plan. There, that is her building right there, the largest building on the Forum in Rome. Floor plan. There is a view from standing in the Forum looking at what would be the front door of the building right there, this portico in front of it. So you get an idea. Now, carved in this portico, there's a broken stone that's down here on the ground, but it was at this level. There's a long inscription telling you who built the building, and the same inscription is also over the back door, and this is what it says. Almachia, who is the daughter of Lucius, who is a public priest, in her own name and that of Marcus Numistrius, the son of Fronto, so her son, erected this calcidicum, this crypt, this porch at her own expense and dedicated them to Augusta and Concord and Pietas. Pietas, the Roman goddess of modesty. Roman Concord, we're one big happy family in the Roman Empire. And modesty. They're dedicated to that. Notice her husband is not mentioned. I'm guessing he's dead. She is an independently wealthy woman now. She probably has inherited her husband's wealth and business. She may also have been from a wealthy family to start with. In any case, she's advancing her son's public career by also building the name in the building in the name of her son. So his name is up there in marble. But she is a prominent citizen, and she is a woman with. She's part of the power elite in Pompeii in the first century. And this statue represents her. Now, I didn't show you the statue base before, but here it is. This is a statue dedicated by the Fuller's Guild to Almachia, the daughter of Lucius, a public priestess, she's called. Public priestess. So that's the other thing about this toga pulled up over her head. A woman does this to show that she's married. A man does this, or a woman does this, in prayer. So a priest is often represented with the toga pulled up over the head, either male or female. This is a sign of reverence, piety before God. So if you think about 1 Corinthians 11 and Paul's suggestions that men should worship bareheaded, I'm thinking there are some Romans in town who are having a problem with that. You know, it's Paul is really tiptoeing through a cultural minefield there. So there are two things here. She's a priestess, but she's also a modest woman, and her clothing represented there does double duty. Not only does she build the biggest building in town, she has one of the biggest tombs outside of town, outside the city gate. This is all that's left of a giant monumental tomb. This whole structure back here was part of her family tomb that she built. So she's doing everything she can to advertise her power and status in Pompeian society. But even as she does that, she represents herself, or is represented, as a woman of modesty and decorum. She kind of doesn't need purple clothes. I don't know, maybe the statue was painted purple. Maybe she did. She doesn't need the gold, the jewelry, because she has buildings to do her talking for her. People in town know her name. She is flaunting her wealth and trying to retain an image of modesty. Now, let's talk about hairstyles a little bit. Here's a popular hairstyle in the first century. There are many, many statues of women, modest women of decorum. The preferred hairstyle is, of course, women had wore hair long, but the hair would be parted in the middle and pulled back and tied in a little bun in the back, right? And when you're out in public, of course, your toga is pulled up over your head, and that's covered anyway. So all you see is the front of the head, and it's just parted in the middle and pulled back. Very simple hairstyle. This is kind of an innovation in the early first century to part the hair into thirds, and the front third is kind of looped back over to form this little, they called it a notice, this little kind of a bouffant on top. That's still considered by the Romans kind of a simple hairdo, modesty and decorum, and it wouldn't get really in the way of your toga. But by the end of the first century, this is what's going on. There are statues all over the place of women wearing this hairstyle. This was the popular hairstyle during the Flavian period. That is to say, the emperors Titus and Vespasian and Domitian of the Apocalypse of John fame, Titus the one who sacked Jerusalem in AD 70, those guys. So the emperors who ruled from 70 to 95 in there, this was the hairstyle that was popular. What do you think about this?
A lot of work.
How do you get the hair to do that?
Very patiently.
And think about this. No hair gel, no hairspray. Okay. Now, that's not even all of it. Because if you turn her around, oh my.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And that's not even it. I'm going to show you a video to show you that's even more complicated than you can imagine from looking at it.
So it's braided, but then do you think she had naturally curly hair, possibly?
Well, a lot of Latin women did, but if you didn't, you're still going to... You need a hairdresser, right? Not only do you need to have among your slaves a skilled hairdresser, you also need leisure time to sit for this to happen.
Yeah.
And are you going to go out into public with this covered up?
No.
There's no point in doing this if you're not going to do it to be seen of men. Now, when Paul says, not with braided hair, put yourself in the cultural... I mean, how long did it take you, Tiffany, to braid your hair?
Julie.
I'm sorry, Julie. I lost Tiffany. Okay. Julie. All right.
I don't know, like less than a minute.
Yeah, right. So you're not wasting a lot of time on this, right?
No.
All right. How long did this take?
Hours.
Yeah. This takes a while. This is complicated. So put yourself in that cultural context. You've got hairstylists. You've got no hairspray. You've got no hair gel. You've got extra fancy stuff, and you're trying to make your hair do this so you can go out in public and look good. Now, here's what I'm getting at. When Paul says, I want women to decorate themselves this way, I think there are two ways to be noticed and get attention in the first century, in the cultural world of the first century. One is you flaunt your wealth and status and power, and people notice and they respect that, and they stand aside for you. So it's your clothing with purple dye and gold thread. It's this kind of hairstyle, and people say, oh, there's somebody important. I'm getting out of the way. I'm showing deference. The other way to make your mark in the Roman world is to go out of your way to be modest and a person of decorum. The very simple hairstyle with the toga pulled up over the head, covering the head. Pastoral Paul is advocating option B. Why? Because Christianity is not about a power trip and status and privilege. Furthermore, it's important that Christians project an image so they can be seen and recognized by people in the Roman Empire as decent, upstanding citizens who are not a threat. Why? Because they go around affirming that there's only one God. So they're already suspect. But Romans say they believe in modesty and decorum. So we Christians are going to call their bluff on that. We're going to go out of our way to project modesty and decorum in a way that they recognize as modest and decorous. And we're not going to do this. Because we're not going to try to compete with the power establishment on their terms. You see? We're competing on moral terms. We're trying to capture the moral high ground, not the power high ground. Does that help you make a little sense of what's going on in 1 Timothy 2? Now, here's the thing. When we talk about modesty and decorum, do we imagine that Pastoral Paul means for us to take the fashion trends of the Roman Empire in the first century as the norm for Christian behavior in all times and places? I think not. Because what counts as modesty or decorum varies from culture to culture, right? But if you say, in whatever culture you're operating in, if you go out of your way to represent yourself by what that culture recognizes as modesty and decorum, then you're presenting a certain kind of witness to that culture. And you're not going to play whatever that culture represents as the power trip. Now, is that hair braids? Is that gold? Is that pearls? What is that? There's Plotina, the wife of Trajan. There's another braided hair, the bouffant, the braided hair. That lovely lass stands in Dallas today. She's from the second century, but she represents modesty and decorum. She's not playing the power trip. All right, we are going to run out of time, but I would like to play a video for you. And I'll warn you that this video is 16 minutes long. The woman's name, who, if you're interested in this, the name Janet Stevens, you see right there, Janet Stevens, you can Google Janet Stevens, and you'll see lots of examples of this. She's a hairstylist who tries to, from art and sculpture and literary references and artifacts, tries to replicate ancient Roman hairstyles for women. It's fascinating. She's got lots of videos. But I want to play a video in which she recreates this hairstyle, the Flavian hairstyle of the late first century, the most popular fashion statement in the late first century. It's going to take her 16 minutes to show how to do this. So there's not another session after this, so you're welcome to stay and watch the whole thing. If you need to leave, I'm not offended if you walk out. You can Google it and find the video yourself, but it's just kind of fun. This is what Paul is talking about when he says, hey, we don't need to do this, all right? By the way, it takes a lot longer than 16 minutes to make this hairstyle. She's just showing you the steps, right? Each step takes longer than... So we'll put it up. And I hope the volume works here.
The Orbis Tamarum, or circular hair coiffure, was the most popular hairstyle of late 1st century AD. Tall, fluffy front hair was balanced by a braided and looped ponytail or a large wreath bun at the back of the head. Many Roman women had tight natural curl, which made the front hair easy to arrange. All they needed to do was to cut their front hair into a mullet shape while leaving the back hair long. Women with naturally straight hair had to curl it, either with a hot Calamistrum curling iron, as attested in literary sources, or perhaps with rag curls using felt fabric, as I suggest here. For stability, the hair could be backcombed and loosely stitched with needle and thread, crucial reinforcement in the days before hairspray. The back hair was more problematic. Extreme length and density was essential for the wreath bun, but not everyone naturally possesses such length and density. Although male poets and moralists disapproved, Roman women frequently resorted to wigs and hairpieces when their natural hair proved insufficient. Close examination of Orbis Camarum portraits indicates that most could have been arranged from the sitter's natural hair. The occasional false bun may be detected. In this tutorial, our model's short hair and fringe will be transformed to that of a fashionable Flavian lady by careful rag setting on felt, arrangement, and the addition of a false wreath bun. Although wet curling is not attested in literary sources, the facts of daily life in Rome make the viable alternative to the weaker Calamistrum curl. The Romans loved to bathe. Many even bathed daily. They would have been familiar with the effects of water evaporation for changing the shape of hair. Also, the Romans were creatures of daylight. The hair could be set at bedtime and dry by morning. Rag curling procedure. Wet the front hair and wind it around strips of felt which have been cut to a size appropriate for the desired curl diameter. These strips were cut to approximately 2 inches by 9 inches, or 5 centimeters by 23 centimeters. As you can see, the curl is secured by tying the ends of the felt across the base of the curl. Alternating the direction of the curls causes the hair to be fluffier once it is combed out. You will only curl the front portion of the head from ear to ear. Allow the hair to dry overnight. In the morning, the following period-appropriate tools would be used to dress the hair. Hair bodkins for parting, combs for smoothing and teasing, needle and thread for stitching the hair in place, and leaf spring scissors to cut excess thread. After removing the rag curls from the front hair, divide the back hair into many small braids using the hair bodkin and the comb. With needle and thread, bind the end of each braid so it can't unravel. Twist the braid ends together and stitch the entire mass low on the nape so that the ends of the braids are concealed. Stitch thoroughly. A firm foundation is necessary for the false bun to stay in place. Creating a false wreath bun. Anachronism alert. Most of ancient wig-making technique is lost to human memory, but from literary sources and artifact sample analysis, it is believed they variously used human and animal hair, leathers and hides, grasses, animal and plant resin glues, and beeswax as materials. The following section intentionally uses modern synthetic materials and tools and means only to invoke the spirit and contour of ancient hairpieces. Separate a strand of hair and tie a knot at the center of the strand. This will give you an anchor for subsequent work. Combine the ends of the hair below the knot. Divide this hair into three strands and braid the false hair all the way to its tips. Synthetic hair tangles easily, so be gentle with it. After braiding to the end of the strand, bind the end with needle and thread to keep it from unraveling. Repeat this process on as many strands of synthetic hair as you desire. You may wish to choose synthetic hair that matches the natural color of your own hair, or blend different colors to create an effect. Once all the braids are finished, set aside one of them. With the needle and thread, string the other braids together through their knotted ends then bind them together securely. Once the knotted ends are bound together, smooth out the braids and decide how wide you want the finished wreath bun to be. At that mark, bind the braids tightly together with needle and thread. Once all is secure, cut the thread to release the needle, then carefully cut off the excess braid ends. Stitch the butt ends together to form a ring. We will finish the wreath bun by using the reserve braid to conceal the join. Stitch the knot end of the reserve braid to the underside of the join, then wrap it tightly around the join twice and stitch it in place. Wrap the remaining length of the reserve braid loosely around the wreath circle, then stitch the end of this braid under the join point. Be sure to stitch securely. Once all is secure, clip off the excess thread and your hairpiece is complete. The key to a natural-looking hairpiece is to match as well as possible the texture, density, and color of the natural hair it will be worn with. Attaching the hairpiece. Using a blunt needle and thread, stitch the wreath bun to the back of the hair. Place it so that it aligns well with the natural braids, concealing their ends. Use thread that matches the color of the hair. Stitch until all is secure. Dressing the Orbis Kamara. Volume comb the previously curled hair. Comb the hair thoroughly and break it up so you get maximum explosion of curl. Thank you. For extra height, back comb to strengthen the shape. There was no hairspray before the 20th century, so this hair will be fragile unless it is reinforced by internal stitching with needle and thread.
I don't know. Anybody want to guess how long would it last? I think for the one night you're going to go to a big party.
Tie a stick knot to the end of the thread.
Sleep on it.
Attach the thread to the hair by passing the needle through the loop of the slip knot. Using a twirling motion with a blunt needle, loosely stitch the hair internally so that the stitches do not show. This will stabilize and refine the shape.
You shake your head to take it down.
Yeah.
Use this technique to stabilize the entire form. The continuity of the thread gives the Orvis Kumara internal strength. Check your work visually for balance.
Well, if you didn't do that attached braid, you'd have to sit through the whole thing for the braiding of the back.
Does the inclusion in 2 Timothy imply that the ladies in Ephesus were doing this?
Well, I'm just saying that's the most fashionable hairstyle of the period of the 80s.
But they were at least tempted to.
If they wanted to reflect the latest Roman fashion trends. Yeah.
It's this kind of thing he means by braiding hair.
Yeah, he said braided hair, pearls, gold. Yeah.
At the end, lightly and carefully back.
Is this related to the Artemis cult at all? Now?
A light touch.
No, it's just fashion.
So I mean, the letter to them is. Ephesus.
Well, Ephesus was the Roman administrative capital of the province. So Roman citizens lived in Ephesus because they were running the government. And people who wanted to emulate the Romans, that's the fashion trend.
The style is now complete.
Don't do this at home. You'll go to hell.
Do you know the term and coloring and the weaves and the things that take a long time that we all
Think about it. Yeah. Think about it. Why do we do that? Thank you all for coming.